people's lives need to be changed by the work we do. And so I think that's what we're trying to figure out. What's out there?
For me, having been involved with the Academy for a long time, one of my interests has always been to get the right data and to get the data right. And that's what we aspired to do.
Welcome to our podcast series. We will have 35 episodes. In this, the lead episode is with Gloria Lansom Billings of the University of Wisconsin and Michael Foyer of the George Washington University, both of whom you've just heard in the opening quotes. They'll be interviewed by David Osher on the work of the National Academy of Education, which commissioned a set of three papers under the title Addressing Educational Inequalities in the Wake of the COVID-19 Pandemic. However, those papers go beyond the wake of the pandemic. They also touch on other issues that are affecting our society, our communities, and the schools that serve them. This opening conversation touches on learning, student support, family engagement, civic reasoning and engagement, culturally responsive pedagogy, and the importance of high-quality evidence that represent a multitude of perspectives and long-term concerns for education equity. These are important concepts to be listening for. You'll hear more about the concepts all through this series, and you'll be learning more about how evidence-based research can be used effectively in schools and other learning settings to enhance and improve the learning and thriving of each student. To lead us off, Gloria Lansom Billings, one of the past presidents of the National Academy, will describe the three papers.
The first paper is really about the fundamental work of schooling, and that is the academic performance. And so we've got to figure out what was happening to ensure student learning. I think the second one is about building the supportive conditions and comprehensive supports to enhance student and educator well-being and thriving. It reminds me of an educator I studied many years ago in Philadelphia by the name of Madeline Cartwright. And Madeline used to say this, I have to deal with whatever gets in the way of student learning. And so what was interesting about her work is she went out and recruited money to buy a washer and a dryer. Now, you might say to yourself, washer and a dryer, what does that have to do with student learning? But Madeline said, if I have kids who are not coming to school because they don't have clean clothes or who are embarrassed because the clothes they have are not clean and so they're not focused on what's happening in the classroom, I have to deal with that. So that paper is, to me, like the background of paper. It's like, what conditions have to be in place for any learning to actually take place? And this is, in many ways, not new information. I'm actually one of the members of the NRC committee that did the first How People Learn. It was 1999 that was published. And we said back then, if you don't deal with the fact that other things are happening in young people's lives, you're not going to get anywhere in a classroom just because you think you have excellent curriculum or because you think you have good materials. Kids come as fully human, and as a result, their mental, emotional, and social well-being has to be attended to. And then that third paper is a paper that talked about supporting families and communities. Indeed, this is, again, a part of a whole. We are finally, I think, at a place in our field where we understand it is not just that one child that walks into your classroom. An entire family walks in there. And it's actually not just the family. A community walks in there with you. And if you're not attending to all of those things, you are going to miss being successful with that child.
As we move into the next section, Michael Foyer of the George Washington University, and also a past president of the National Academy of Education, is going to be discussing what brought the Academy to commission these papers. By way of introduction, the National Academy of Education advances high-quality research to improve education, policy, and practice. It was founded in 1965 and consists of members from the U.S. and the international communities who are elected on the basis of scholarship as it impacts and relates to education. The Academy does undertake research studies to address pressing educational issues and administers professional development fellowship programs to enhance the preparation of the next generation of scholars. In this part one of a three-part series, the interview is conducted by David Osher. David is the primary interviewer for the series as well as its co-designer. As you will discover from his current associations, which I'll be listing in a moment, his network has allowed him to connect with many friends and colleagues that produces this series. His associations include being a member of the National Academy of Education, as well as a senior fellow at the Learning Policy Institute, a fellow at the ESOL Lab of the Harvard University Graduate School of Education, a fellow of the Education Collaboratory at Yale University, a research associate at the Center for the Study of Resilience at the University of Pretoria, an honorary fellow at the Learning Lab at the University of Queensland in Australia, and a fellow at the American Education Research Association. We also have a list of his significant publications on our website. David?
Why did the National Academy commission these three papers?
The questions of having to do with educational inequality before, during, and after the pandemic, we were very grateful to the W.T. Grant Foundation to recognize that this was an opportunity for the Academy to bring together some expertise and to weigh in on this. In terms of the form, let me just also say that on a topic such as the pandemic and its effects on educational opportunity and outcomes, and inequality in particular, there are a lot of voices out there. There are a lot of opinions. There's a lot of, shall I say, more perhaps partisan-oriented points of view about what are the origins of the problem and what we should be doing about it as a society. And the special, maybe comparative advantage of the National Academy of Education is that we think first and foremost about the evidence base, and that we do this through a kind of consensus building process where from the get-go, we know that people come to this with a healthy set of, but a different set of values, dispositions, points of emphasis. And then the question is, can there be a sense of what do the data actually tell us about these problems and what are some of the better options for the way policymakers and educators can and should be thinking about these things. So for only two reasons, I think it made a great deal of sense for the Academy to do this, the one being substance and the other being process. And that's partly what motivated us to conceive of this project. And then, of course, to engage with scholars and educators to make sure that we're getting at least some of this as right as we can. I suppose for me, having been involved with the Academy for a long time, one of my interests has always been to get the right data and to get the data right. And that's what we aspired to do in this case also.
Thank you, Michael. I think getting the right data and getting the data right is always important. It's probably especially important in this historical moment when what is the right data and how do we get it right is being so contested. These three papers seem to relate to the series of roundtables that the National Academy conducted in 2020 on COVID-19 and inequality. How do you see them as being related?
I suppose what the word that gets bandied about here is ecosystem these days. By the way, I like the ecosystem thing because what I aspire to with the Academy work is not to have just an ecosystem. Thinking about the ecosystem with a range of voices is partly what we try for here. And those three papers, in a way, and the convenings that we had with these roundtables led us to the development of a conceptual model in which issues of community, family, classroom engagement, social and emotional aspects of learning, cultural responsive and culturally influenced aspects of teaching and learning and need to be thought of somehow coherently, but in a way that promotes better understanding, not just by the researchers who do this all the time, but by the general public, and in particular by legislators and decision makers and policy makers who may themselves have a points of view that they bring to this and don't necessarily benefit from the opportunity to think a little bit more coherently and conceptually. So that's where the convenings helped us as a committee, as a steering committee. This was an opportunity for us to build out from those convenings into a model that we think will have longer shelf life even than these papers or than whatever we end up posting on behalf of the Academy about this. Again, my main goal, and I think Gloria shares this, is to promote a rich dialogue and an ongoing discourse more than it is to assume that we've come up with the definitive solutions to these complex problems. We think we've made some good progress in, let's just say, scraping off some of the either irrelevant or not necessarily trustworthy ideas about how to proceed in this matter. But that still stops short of saying that here's exactly what we should do as a nation or as a state or even as a school district, but to give educators better ideas about what research is suggesting, in some cases more and in other cases less forcefully, about the data being right and the right data being applied.
Thank you. Michael, I want to move to your corpus of work. And one of the areas that you have been concerned with is civic education and its relationship to democracy. And last year, you did an interesting podcast with Raymond Pierce of the Southern Education Foundation, where you really were talking about the importance of civic education to democracy. We are now in a historical moment where not only is evidence being challenged, not only is DEI being challenged, but people are attempting to intentionally erase history and to rewrite history. How does that relate to civic education and what educators need to be thinking about and doing in their work with students?
I don't want that to be confused with opinions or positions or even findings from this Academy study of one particular very important set of questions having to do with inequality and the pandemic. I'll just say that my very perhaps vulgarized answer is that regardless of how anyone feels about the origins or the specifics of what you've identified as an assault on research-based evidence, I think for me, sustaining an academy process that demonstrates the value of evidence that, to the best extent possible, is shielded from partisan and commercial and political influence is a way to stand firm, and that we want to continue to provide our ideas of where the evidence is pointing. To the extent that the evidence will be respected, used, tolerated, implemented, translated by people in or out of government, perhaps vulgarized answer is that regardless of how anyone feels about the origins or the specifics of what you've identified as an assault on research-based evidence, I think for me, sustaining an academy process that demonstrates the value of evidence that, to the best extent possible, is shielded from partisan and commercial and political influence is a way to stand firm, and that we want to continue to provide our ideas of where the evidence is pointing. To the extent that the evidence will be respected, used, tolerated, implemented, translated by people in or out of government,
yeah, I was actually going to bring that up. That's the connection, is that we have been looking at civic reasoning and engagement as a fundamental aspect of what it means to be engage in schooling in a democratic society. And I think one of the challenges that we now have is that people have placed a diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice off to the side as if they are not integrated into what it means to be a Democrat, small d, right? That the democracy requires these things. And I think that's one of the shortcomings that DEI has had, is to make itself separate as opposed to integral to the Democratic project.
If, Gloria, a couple of responsiveness and teacher-student relationships underscored in the 2020 roundtables, they're also central to the series of podcasts that we're doing. You seminally conceptualized and operationalized culturally relevant pedagogy 30 years ago as having three components. What are those three components? How are they relevant to these three papers? And how are they relevant to this historical moment?
Thank you, David. Yeah, there are essentially three components to what I've called culturally relevant pedagogy. They include academic achievement, or more specifically, student learning. I've argued that student learning is broader than academic, at least people's conceptualizations of academic achievement, because I'm not just talking about test performance. But we know kids learn a lot more than we could ever test. So student learning. The second is notion of cultural competence. And by that, I'm talking about the ability of students to embrace their own culture, understand it, what psychologists would think of as prior learning, right? That what I already know is going to help me learn other things. But not just knowing your own culture, but becoming fluent and facile in at least one other culture. So in some ways, that doesn't leave any student off the hook. Even if a student might be considered, quote, mainstream, they, in a global society, need to know more than their culture. I'm situated in Wisconsin, but I have been on farms in Wisconsin when there are people, interns from around the world, Portugal, Brazil, Korea, Japan, on these farms learning the latest dairy techniques. Those farmers are actually graduates of the University of Wisconsin who have received what I would call a culturally relevant education, because they know how to go back to their farms, which they always wanted to do, but they also know how to get out into the world. So that cultural competence is a dual thing. It is knowing my own culture, understanding it, and appreciating it, but also developing the facility and the fluency in yet another culture. And then the third part, which I often call the most ignored part, and it may have to do with similar points that Michael made earlier about the polarization and the partisanship that we see. But that third part is what I would call a critical consciousness or socio-political consciousness. In other words, in high school language, it's the so what factor. Okay, I know this now. So what am I going to do with it? What difference does this make in my life? And so it's really about helping students to solve the problems that they themselves come with. I know we see all kinds of iterations of problem solving in schools, but one of the things that is frustrating for me as a teacher educator is that they're not problems that the kids have come up. Well, I cannot tell you how many classrooms I have been in and they're saving the rainforest. And I ask the fundamental question of a third grader, where's the rainforest? And they say to me, I have no idea. This is something she wants to do. So that's not what I mean by problem solving. That's a good goal, that you want to improve the environment, you want to save the rainforest. But kids may have simple problems like, why is the hat rule in our school unequally applied? Why is it that some kids always get stopped? And I'm giving this example because I've actually seen a teacher take that up and say, is that true, number one? And how can we find out? And have students actually do a survey in which they are able to determine, yet stopped and sanctioned around the hat rule, which then ends up in a report that kids have written using those literacy and numeracy skills, sociopolitical consciousness, are the components of culturally relevant pedagogy. How do they relate to this project that we've just engaged in? Number one, we were all gobsmacked with COVID-19. We should not pretend, oh, it was just a thing that happened. We did not anticipate it. So when it came, we found ourselves trying to build the plane that we were flying. I was in a meeting in Detroit with Michael Casterly from the Council of Great City Schools, and he talks about the fact that not only was there inequality, But what has happened subsequently is those at the top have actually done even better. And those at the very bottom have slipped further behind. So that's really the challenge I think we were facing with these papers. It's really about what's working. Let's stop kind of navel-gazing. Let's stop saying, oh, woe is me. Let's figure out what's happening in the field that's working that could be replicated. What's out there that we could actually help improve people's lives?
Can I piggyback with a few footnotes on Gloria's wonderful summary?
Yeah.
First, although these days attention to issues of inequality is viewed by some people as being part of a, shall we say, left-wing ideological agenda, the evidence is really quite different. This has been a topic, a concern, a preoccupation of American educators and policymakers, regardless of their, shall we say, partisan or party affiliation. For decades, every president we've had, Democrat and Republican, has wanted to be the education president. And in making that somewhat noble, if perhaps at times grandiose, self-proclamation, there has been quite open attention to the fact that we have, on the one hand, been involved in an incredible, radical experiment in pluralist democratic education, and that some of our founding visions for education, if not for the whole republic, are still a work in progress, and that therefore we have to keep paying attention to this. So if anybody thinks that the Academy's work on inequality post-COVID is motivated only by some kind of a political point of view, the evidence, again, is really quite important to counter that argument. The second thing I would say in regard to Gloria's point about the emotional environment and the community coming into the classroom, again, this is something that people, regardless of their citizen points of view on all kinds of things, are willing and able to acknowledge with a certain appreciation for how complex this whole thing is. It was a political scientist at Harvard many years ago, Dick Elmore of blessed memory, who used this rather interesting imagery of someone flying over the United States and, God forbid, falls out of the plane. The chances of landing in one of the best schools in the world and the chances of landing in one of the worst schools in the world are probably pretty even. And not only that, that those differences can occur within a mile. This is where attention to the reality doesn't mean that there is a single point of view about what to do about it. And that's where we think that helping people who care about these issues with the advantage of research that shows things that either have already started, quote unquote, working, or that show great promise of having some positive impact, or that are compared to other options, more cost effective and more likely to happen in our lifetimes. Those are the kinds of things this kind of work was oriented to. I'll just say one other thing about the business of this very complex thing we call education in schools, where there is a kind of porous or a membrane between the school and the community. There's a lot of coming and going through that, through those doors. One of the challenges that educators face is dealing with the relevance of what's happening in the classroom compared to the reality that kids are facing when they go home. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that anything that can be done, for example, to improve the possibilities for academic accomplishment, for academic knowledge gaining, needs to be put in the context of how will this kind of knowledge square with the experience that young people have when they go home, and we know homes are very different places, when they go to their communities, which are very different places, as one of our most distinguished scholars of education, Jim Banks from the University of Washington, has written so eloquently about his own experience as a child in, I think, Marietta, Georgia. Marietta, Arkansas, sorry. Where inside the classrooms, there was a lot of talk about democratic principles, how a bill becomes a law, civic engagement, the role of law, the role of the aspiration to egalitarian principles in our Declaration of Independence and founding documents, and then to go home and on the way encounter rabid, horrible, physical and rhetorical racist violence. How can teachers actually understand that that kind of juxtaposition of classroom-based knowledge and instruction with the lived experience that young people have in and around their communities? This makes physicists who are looking for the origins of the universe, I think they've got an easier job than fourth grade teachers trying to deal with all of these kinds of issues on a daily basis.
And can I just pick up on Michael's point about presidential administrations and their understanding of education? Because education is perhaps one of our most useful foreign policy tools. You can go around the world and people will want to say, one day I want to come to America. I want to go to school in America. And so most presidents have realized education is a wonderful tool for us to recruit the best and brightest from around the world, and also to demonstrate that democracy works.
Thank you, Michael and Gloria. This has been a rich conversation. Gloria, your points about cultural responsiveness are so important and are central to education and equity. Michael, your points regarding the fact that we need to focus on a learning ecosystem and not a political ecosystem that, among other things, ends up weaponizing cultural responsiveness rather than seeing it as a tool to promote learning is very important. Both of you pointed out that education and education equity for decades has been a nonpartisan issue, and it is important for us to remember that if our nation is to succeed politically and economically, we need that education.
David, that was informative, and thank you, Gloria and Michael, for your discussion on the complexity of the challenges engaging schools, families, and communities. In the second episode of this set of three, we will hear from former West Virginia Governor Bob Wise, who will introduce us to the three P's of policy, politics, and pedagogy, as well as that there are schools and communities experiencing enormous change. While all in the learning environment are dealing with the wake of COVID, many schools are coping with the impact of political polarization, and all are dealing one way or the other with the pluses and minuses of the rapid changes being brought on by AI. And then in the third episode of this set, Scott Palmer of the Education Council will focus not only on the profound impact on the ability of students to engage with teachers during the pandemic, but will also discuss the development of the Science of Learning and Development Alliance, which is promoting research-based practices that are essential for improving learning.